Hey, it's me, Whit Schiller, and together we are in our 10th episode of the Improv Comedy Connection. Double digits. We made it. Thanks for those early adopters and for the helpful feedback and suggestions that I think have really made a difference. But you're not here just for that, but for the insights and perspective from today's guest, Jules Munns. Jules is an improviser, he's an instructor and co-founder and artistic director of the Nursery Theater in London. You'll benefit from hearing about his journey in improv and how that's dovetailed with the growth happening in the improv scene in London and the UK more broadly, but you'll want to listen close to the insights from Jules that are sprinkled throughout our conversation, and listen through to the end to discover why this is our first episode with an alternate title. So let's get into the Candy and Hugs episode of the Improv Comedy Connection with Jules Munns. I am with Jules Munns today from London. I've been looking forward to this conversation, Jules, for a lot of reasons.
Is it because we failed to have it on about 7 different occasions?
Yeah, scheduling was tough, but you've had some challenges at the Nursery Theater that hopefully will be resolved by the time that this episode drops in terms of space, et cetera, which is a challenge. But yeah,
thank you very much for your optimism.
I said hopefully. I don't know if that's optimistic, yeah. But it is an important, I know, part of the improv scene in London, and that has been something that you have watched and participated in the development of since you got started improv. But I'd like to start going back to your first experience with improv, and you describe your first experience with improv as being terrifying, something that would keep you up the night before class.
Yeah.
Can you just share what that experience was, but also with the flavor of what was terrifying about it?
Well, I guess you're talking about the experience of doing improvisation classes at the Guildhall School where I was doing my BA. My university degree is technically in professional acting, which I find hilarious. You could do a BA in amateur acting.
Right. That's an associate's degree.
Yeah, exactly. It's not technically my first experience of improvisation, but it is my first experience of doing improvisation. So I guess I was an academic kid. I was a smart kid. I was someone who was quite bookish. I didn't find school all that difficult. I didn't find it all that fun, but I found it fairly easy. And I tended to be able to look at, oh, this is this piece of math. This is the system we apply. I'll apply that system. And then the answers come out correct. Yeah. Wasn't very creative in the slightest, but I was able to kind of take if I took a hammer and there was a whole bunch of nails, I could hit all the nails pretty fast. If you asked me to do something more elegant or complex or imaginative, that was less my thing. Mm-hmm. So when I went on to university and I read English literature and language at the University College London. And at that point, I thought I wanted to be an academic because that seemed like the logical place to go with a mind like mine.
Sure.
I'm pretty persistent. I'm not particularly detail focused, but I can take a bunch of information and shake it down and make new information out of it. So I did that. But what I realized there was that I don't want to spend as much time alone as I thought I did. And I would spend days in the library and realize that I was really missing having people around.
Okay.
And I'd done some bits and pieces of drama. So I ended up going to drama school after university. And I say this as a background to show that I came into drama from a linguistic, cerebral, carefully planned, understood angle.
Yeah.
So my way of approaching being in a show would be to break everything down, understand the backstory, get the research. There's nothing I like more at drama school than really going deep dive into the sort of social history at the time and trying to work out why in every single Chekhov play where someone whistles, someone gets annoyed. Like, what is it about whistling in 19th century Russia, which is a particular thing? So this would mean that when I went into rehearsal for doing a show, whether it was, you know, drama school or outside drama school, I'd have a huge amount of information in my brain, a huge amount of preparation. I'd feel like I was prepared. I feel like I was ready.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that. I don't think that's a bad way of doing things. And I flatter myself that I had some game as an actor. I wasn't amazing, but I was fine. Mm-hmm. I could do the job. And then we had these improvisation classes on a Friday morning, and there was something so interesting about how exposing. I remember this, the one dumb exercise. I can't actually remember what what it was called. Yeah. But one person's in the middle of the circle and they start doing an action and a sound and they repeat it, you know, a little 2-3 second loop.
Right.
To make eye contact with someone around the circle and they start to mirror it. And then gradually the person around the circle, who's on the outside of the circle, comes into the middle. The person stops doing it. The person who's come into the middle transforms it into something else. And then, you know, rinse and repeat.
Yep.
It's a very basic kind of warm-up thing. There was something about that kind of exercise where I couldn't understand how doing that thing could be good or bad. Like how you could do something in the middle of that circle that would be fun to watch or not fun to watch, or charismatic or not charismatic, or whatever vocabulary you want to use mm-hmm. to describe it, mm-hmm. whether good or bad is kind of problematic in an improv context. And yet I was standing there in the circle watching it going, but it is. I want to watch this stupid movement that someone is making, and I'm less interested in the next stupid movement that someone is making. There's something here where the liveness and immediacy of what is going on can be better or worse, and it's nothing to do with preparation, because I can see that what is being created here isn't prepared.
Right.
And I think that for me, do you know the talking pig example?
I'm not sure that I do.
So it's a thing used in science. Some examples in science where you say this is an outlier result. This does not fit the rest of the bell curve. It doesn't matter because it's one result in 100. We can ignore it. But if I were to bring a talking pig on stage, which is an outlier, I bring a talking pig on stage at the scientific conference and I have a conversation with him. And I see that he can talk and he can talk in a way that he can have a conversation with me. Mm-hmm. That's not something which can just be knocked aside and ignored as an outlier. That's right. Something which changes everything we understand about biology, human exceptionalism, psychology, language, like all these kind of huge things. So standing watching this exercise and thinking I am drawn to when this person does it and I am not drawn to when this person does it was for me a talking pig. It was I can't just ignore this because it's told me something that I can't ignore about how I understand performance, because I've been thinking you can prepare your way to greatness.
Right.
And actually, I'm looking at this stupid repeated noise and sound patterns which people are doing and thinking, that one was great. That one didn't work. And I was so intrigued by that. I wanted to add those tools to my tool belt you know, weapons to my armory. And that's why I sort of threw myself into it. That was a long explanation.
Yeah, it dragged for a bit. No, I find this very interesting too, because I think you have this on your site, julesmunz.com. Mm. And I think I've heard you say the word terrifying though. And your description of that experience didn't sound terrifying to me.
Yeah, fair enough. I described it in the kind of, I suppose there's, I was giving the reasons why I wanted to walk into the terror rather than walk away from the terror. I'm also terrified of spiders, but I have no interest in engaging with them.
Yeah.
So yeah, I guess for me, it was a very exposing thing. Being a bookish kid, being a smart kid, being the kid that gets good results in exams, you're not expected to be the one that everyone laughs at, everyone talks to. You're not expected to be the popular kid in the class, right? So the pressure of, so that kind of situation of being, creating material live and not knowing what's going to happen and responding and eyes on you and all that kind of stuff, I guess set off those memories of being at school and thinking, God, I wish I could just disappear. At least I can cope with the books. So I think it's probably that rejection cycle, which was kind of going off and talking about in terms of terror. I also, I remember Patsy Rodenberg, who's, I don't know if she teaches at the Guildhall School anymore, but she used to be head of voice, I guess, or something like that.
Is she the one with the circles theory?
Yeah, that's right. First, I mean, I think it comes from, Stanislavski originally, but that's her book is First Circle, Second Circle, Third Circle. Got a different name in the US than in the UK, I think. And the first thing she said that when she came into the first class on the day two of the first year, she walked in and she said, "You're all here because your power has been interfered with." And then she kind of launched into this description of how voice is related to power, is related to psychology, is related to one's feeling of mm-hmm. belonging, is in the UK related to class. I know that's less of an important concept in the US. So I guess for me, the stuff around improvisation got to the heart of that feeling of power or lack of it, deserving of attention or lack of it, ability to talk to people or lack of it. Improvisation got right to the heart of it because it wasn't something that I could be prepared to do well in the way you could with a presentation or a show or something. And it's also interesting that I have often talked about, as you said, I kind of avoided the idea of terror. I've often casually mentioned that as part of a question or a point I'm making in interviewing someone else. But when you turn it round back on me in a very British way, I instantly conceal it and talk about the other emotional aspects of it because it's uncomfortable to talk about that stuff, right?
I do think it's interesting how we are socialized, whether that's just on a broader scale or whether that's sort of our individual experience. I mean, you talk about having a bookish nature as a kid. I think about sort of my childhood experience and how that impacted my own improv journey and my openness to it and my ability to lean into things and things to, you know, that are more difficult to let go of.
What was your childhood journey? What was your, what was the thing that you came from?
Well, this will probably drag. I just think we had a move in the middle of second grade, and I went.
Which is about 12, 13?
No, second grade would be 7 or 8, something like that.
Okay, right.
So we moved in the middle of the school year, and I went from a very kind of happy, you know, friends with everybody kind of situation to this new kid who was the new fish in the fish tank. And, you know, trying to find your own space was kind of tough. So I was a smart, bookish kid. But I think some of the humor aspect came out of having to sort of find my way in a new society that wasn't as open. And then it just kind of, you know, goes from there a little bit.
Yeah, that sounds exactly the same as my partner, Heather Urquhart, who's also a very fine improviser and teacher, and you should talk to her sometime. She was born in Scotland and spent the first 6 or 7 years of her life in Glasgow and then came down to the South. And I don't know how much you know about British culture and British accents in particular, but that is, the Glasgow accent is borderline incomprehensible to someone from where I'm from. And then I think in the next 5 or 6 years, she moved 5 or 6 times because of her father's job. So she was constantly having to do what you're talking about and make everyone in a situation think that she's great and trustworthy and lovely and feel comfortable with her. So that's one of her big driving things that she's doing in improv classes, is trying to create a situation where everyone can feel comfortable with each other and everyone can communicate with each other in a way which is mutually supportive. And it goes right back to when she was 7 or 8. When she came down from Glasgow to the South, she said to the other kids in her primary school that she was Glas Norwegian because she didn't know what the correct word for it was.
Well, and those skill sets are things I think we can both find ourselves projecting and trying to pull people in while at the same time being self-protective. And when you talk about your experience, it sounds like there was a little bit of a cognitive dissonance about how to approach life. And to me, it sounded like presence, being present was probably something that was pulling you in to at least be intrigued by what you were watching, even if maybe that isn't how you would name it at that time. But you decided to join a school-related improv troupe after that to dig into that more?
Yeah, that's right. There was a guy in the year below me who, I don't think he does improv anymore, but he'd done some when he was at Oxford University. There's a company called the Oxford Imps, which is a, can you say, is breeding ground a positive word? Or does that sound negative to you?
Well, if you hadn't asked, I wouldn't have had a negative reaction to the word, but now it sounds terrible. I think otherwise okay. It's fine. I've never heard that as a negative term.
Okay, good. That's good. I was wondering if I was describing Oxford University as like a petri dish or something. But it's so many great improvisers have come through the Oxford Imps, and I think Ty was one of the this guy in the year below me was one of the founder members, and he was so he would have been in his first year. I would have been in my second year. I think that's right. And he had this like 2 or 3 pages of lists of games with the briefest of descriptions. I don't know where they came from. I guess that must have been something that someone had given to someone at the Oxford Imps, and it was before there was a huge amount of resources on the internet to work with.
These are short form games?
Yeah, these are short form games. We attempted to do narrative because that's what we thought long form was, and ooh man, was that an unpleasant experience. And so we just got together. I think the first couple of times that we met, there was like 25 people, which is, this is a department of 75 people or so. There's only 25 to maybe a little bit more than 25 in each of the 3 years. So it was a large percentage of the department were interested in this. And then over the 6 months or so in the way that improv teams do, it boiled down to maybe 6 or 8 of us. I had this really bizarre experience, which at the time was just the only thing available to me. Now I realize what a rare thing it is kind of globally among the improvisers that I know, that we were just a bunch of 6 or 8 mates who got together every Wednesday and Sunday evening for 6 months before we did anything like a performance, and with pretty much no external input. Because at that point, there were improv classes in London, but there certainly wasn't anyone with a structured, numbered program. And not saying that numbered program is the only way to learn improv, but there was nothing like that. There were some drop-in classes, and there was Mark Phoenix doing stuff at City Lit, which is a very different sort of thing. But this was what was available to us. There wasn't really much on the internet for us to go off. We had these scrappy bits of paper, so we just did it. And we would take the games and sort of turn the dials on them just to see why they worked that way. So, okay, well, this is, you know, the game Onion Skin? So you have one person does a one-person scene, and then someone joins, and it becomes a different two-person scene, a different three-person scene, until you have a five-person scene. And then people leave in the same order. Yeah. It's a fairly kind of classic, like bridging short form into long form game. And I remember sort of taking an afternoon of trying to break every rule of that game and discover why those were the rules of that game. So like, what if it's 3 rather than 5? What if it's 7 rather than 5? What if people are allowed to leave in different orders from the ones they arrived in? What if when you join, something different happens? I don't remember what we came up with, but like every single element of the description that we had in the scrappy little bit of paper, we changed in order to work out. But I think we changed it in order to, because we thought we were smart, being smart and original. And the conclusion that we came to at the end of the afternoon was, oh no, the person who wrote this down knew what they were talking about. And I think that was the extraordinary experience of being in that set of people for that kind of, probably ended up being maybe a little bit more than 2 years, was we were able to question absolutely everything. And we were able to do things enough times that we really got to understand how it feels. I think when you're in an improv class, and if you're in an improv team, that can be a dangerous neophilia, that people want a new piece of advice or a new improv game or a new warm-up or a new scene angle every class, and that's not necessarily helpful. One of the things I say to my students all the time is, no one goes to a yoga class and says, hey, we did these positions last week, I want new positions. But there's something about that thrill of the new, that dynamism of doing something new, which makes us want to do that in an improv context. But because of where I started out as an improviser and when I started out as an improviser, that was the only option available to me, because we had these like 20 or 30 games. Yeah. And that's just what we did for years. And I'm super jealous of someone being able to sign up to a level 1 course and go through to a level 5 course and have a coherent syllabus. But I'm also really glad I had that.
Yeah, I think the newness aspect and always chasing the next thing does avoid the depth of the principles or experience with the old, or at least the familiar.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Are there some things that you hearken back to in that experience and that process that you feel are drivers for how you approach improv today?
I think there's something about, it's a really good question. There's something about creating a micro community, which is incredibly emotionally supportive and present, but at the same time, striving for the highest level of professionalism and refusing to let either of those two goals be compromised for the other one. You know, seeing those two goals as things which complement each other rather than threaten each other. To my mind, I think that's the thing that I really experienced there, because we were a drama school, and the constant rhetoric of the teachers, and we were, you know, 40, 50, 60 hours a week in that subterranean, horrible building. The rhetoric was, when you're at the BBC, when you're at the National, when you're at the RSC, the Royal Shakespeare Company, when you're doing these big shows, this is how you treat everyone else and yourself as the professional which we are training you to be. It took me a long time to get out of the feeling that NT, RSC, and BBC were the indicators of success in a career. But that's another kind of question. But it definitely bled into the evening rehearsals, because we would always be thinking of, how do we make this really, really good? And how do we make this something which people really, really want to watch, while at the same time looking each other after each other? Because we didn't get, you know, we used to perform down in the Student Union, a place called The Basement over in Sundial Court in the City of London. And, you know, we'd leave at the end of the night with enough for a pint, maybe. So it really was a labour of love. We had to be there because we loved doing the stuff and we loved each other. But we were also in an environment where we were being pressed to be artistic leaders of our generation, at the risk of sounding horribly pretentious.
Well, that's the school's goal.
Yeah,
right?
It's the school's goal. And one of the guys who was in my year played Brian May in the Queen film. Like, it works. It happens.
Mm-hmm.
2 years below me was Lily James, who's now in absolutely everything, and deservedly so. That both Willem and Lily are fantastic actors. That was the goal. That was the training. That was what we were being given, which is very, very different to a lot of people who come to improv schools to kind of work their way through the levels. They might want to be a professional improviser, but there's also a sense of realism around how many jobs there are being a professional improviser in the whole world, let alone in the UK, where it's a fairly unknown art.
I think there's a challenge too, because the class fee is a very important part of a lot of improv theaters, which ends up probably casting a wider net for those who might just kind of want to mess around, or maybe I'll meet some people or things like that. Not bad goals, but very different goals from someone who says, I want to make this a professional pursuit. So you have courses that I suppose have to bend a little bit to the economic pressures of that, where when you're in a drama school, you have self-selected yourself in to be a professional at this particular discipline. That's a very different kind of mentality.
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. And I think if you look at a lot of schools as a business model, they are improv teaching schools with a theatre tacked on the side from a financial point of view. And this is not a criticism of any of that in the slightest. That's how we do it at the nursery. That's the simplest way of making money. And for some people, it's a corporate training school with a much, much smaller class system with an even smaller theatre tacked on the side, just because people got to make bank. And I really get that. I think the fact that it's to do with our expectation, our elision of value with financial value, or of worth with financial value, that we see those as bad things. The professionalization of the arts is not a necessary thing in the slightest. Anyway, you're going to ask a different question.
No,
I can talk about financial models
well,
all day.
But it does impact the art, which is, and I don't know that we need to spend a lot of time, because I do want to get back to sort of the journey in London, but the places that seem to be less dependent on that are those that have a short form focus or have a high sketch focus to what they do, because there are broader paying audiences for those things, as opposed to the audiences are students and long form improvisers supporting each other. That doesn't mean you change the model, but it certainly creates an environment with challenges if the long form pursuit is going to be primary in focus for a school.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You finish your time in drama school, and now you are heading out into the world, and improv is still part of your story at that point. But it seemed to me you had to decide to carve out your own way a little bit. Can you describe how you moved your journey from that environment to out there in the big wide world?
Yeah. So as I graduated, I stayed improvising with the impresarios. So I would go back to the college in the evening and on the Sunday afternoons to go and do those rehearsals. And I was doing bits and pieces of acting work, and I was doing auditions and all those kind of things. And I was also, there was a group of us from my year at the Guildhall and a couple of people from the same year at the Lambda, which is another drama school in London, who got together and started I was sort of gradually working towards understanding, oh, the improvisation is the thing that I wanted. And we started doing devised work. So improvising and then re-improvising and then trying to make shows out of that. And we would get together fairly regularly and we're trying to get together towards making a show. And it just took so long for me to form the thought that I loved the first time we improvised something. And then after that, I just wasn't in the slightest. I was like, oh, we got to improvise it again.
Yeah.
Why? I mean, what the hell's the point? And obviously, in order to make a show, that's the answer to that question. It just wasn't something which tickled me.
Was this improv to sketch or improv to full play?
Yeah, improv to, I guess we would probably call it piece rather than play, because I don't think we're aiming for something
that grand.
It definitely wasn't aiming in the comic direction, but more in a something a bit more abstract and weird, I suspect. But we never really got as far as making a full show that we were happy with. We made a thing and thought, well, this is not what we want to make, and then the whole thing fell apart. So I was doing the improv, I was doing this thing, and it was the improv at the center of that was making me interested. And then my perfectly formed sort of Road to Damascus experience was I had an audition for the RSC, the Royal Shakespeare Company, and I think it was three rounds. I got through the first round, I got through the second round. Last round was me and this other guy, not in the same audition room, but it was, they're like, one of the two of you, you know, you got a 50% chance of getting this part. And it was an 18-month tour playing Romeo. Yeah. So this is the, you know, this is the peak. This is the thing we've been training for. This is the World Cup. And I went along and I did the audition, really liked the director. And there was someone else in the room. I forget what her title was, but they were both really cool. And then on the way home, I was kind of cycling home, having had a really fun time. They called me and they said, we really couldn't decide between you and the other guy. We really liked you both. In the end, we decided to go with the other guy solely on the basis that he's a little shorter than you. I'm not crazy tall, I'm 6'1", but he's a little shorter than you. The Juliet is already cast.
Uh-huh.
She's quite short, like really quite short. And your height difference would look strange. And like totally fair enough. There is, like, if you can't decide, that's as good a reason as any to choose between one piece of thinking meat and another piece of thinking meat. But as I put down the phone, I was like, thank you so much. That's a wonderful, you know, in your first year of or year and a half of being graduated from drama school, that's a lovely thing to hear. I wasn't down about it at all. Put the phone down and realized that I was relieved. Because I was still able to do all these other improv commitments. And this was an 18-month global tour as Russia and Japan and all kinds of cool places, which I would love to go to and still haven't gone to.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone's out there in Russia or Japan and needs an improv teacher. And I realized, oh, okay. I didn't really want to do that. I just spent 3 years hearing that was the highest goal of the training that I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, all of these things were kind of piecing together to finally make this thought of, oh, improv is the thing I want to do, which then meant that I had to find professional training. I had to find someone that, a set of people that aspires to the same level of professionalism and isn't just a bunch of us teaching each other. Because although we had a lovely time and I think we did some good shows, it's very hard to look back accurately over. You know, more than a decade. But I think we did some good stuff considering what we were working with. So that was when, at that point, we'd started off doing the nursery. The nursery was a festival for the first couple of years, and we just hired out an old railway arch, turned it into a theatre for some shows. Some of the shows were improvised, some of the shows were not improvised. And as a result of that, we were invited to organise an improv-specific festival at a place called the Old Vic Tunnels, which is underneath Waterloo Station. And we were asked to organise this festival. We said yes, because that's what you say when Kevin Spacey's assistant, you know, this is pre-scandal, when Kevin Spacey's assistant says, can you organize a festival? You say yes and work out how afterwards.
What was the interest from them in having an improv-specific festival? Where did that come from?
They had a little bit more time and a little bit more money than they thought in this space, right? Because it was a kind of temporary space.
Okay.
And they were looking for someone that could fill that space very, very, very fast. And one of the trustees are the non-exec directors of a charity, which is what we call a non-profit, translating for American audience.
Yeah.
One of their trustees is a guy that I had met at an improv workshop, and he just casually said, oh, have you heard of the nursery? They've done I think he misremembered and said they did an improv festival. Why didn't you get them to do it?
Gotcha.
And so they did, because there was just like the amount of people doing regular improv in London was that small that was the context in which someone could make a connection. Mm-hmm. It's not that there was no one. I'm not saying we're the first people there in the slightest, because you know I want to be really careful of that.
No, I understand
that whole narrative. Yeah. That's been abused in London on a couple of occasions. You know, it just happened that we were asked to be in touch. And when we had the meeting with these two guys from the Old Vic, it was 6 weeks from 6 weeks and a day from that meeting to the first night of the festival. And we managed to pull it off. So that was part of the reason why improv seemed like such an attractive thing. It's like, well, it's improvisation. You don't need to rehearse. Right.
And you don't need to plan.
that whole thing. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The whole Picasso story. And so we, when that happened, I just Googled, hey, who does improv in London or the Southeast? And I emailed them and said, hey, we're doing an improv festival. You want to come? And pretty much everyone said yes. And then we had an improv festival, which then sold out because there's a lot of people vaguely interested, but a lack of a central kind of node. So that's how that happened.
Yeah. So at that time, it seems to me that there was a evolution in the craft that you were also pursuing. And maybe this was in part after the festival where you started to look for some more things outside in terms of whether that was from the U.S. or other places. How would you describe your improv at that time when the Slapdash Festival was first being put up?
Personally?
Yeah, or the nursery theater, or, you know, your main activities.
I think at that point, the nursery didn't have any, it was just a festival and a kind of production company, so it didn't have a sense of its own identity, its own kind of improvisation identity. Personally, I think having come to improv in the way that we kind of described earlier, my improv was probably quite bold and primary colors-y, quite simple. Mm-hmm. I sort of hesitate to use the word comic because I don't know how it is in the US, but in the UK, sometimes the term comedy improv is used by people to dismiss other forms of improv. And I don't mean that in the slightest, but I suspect it was pretty broad. I suspect it didn't have a lot of subtlety to it. I suspect that it was instinct led in a way which is as negative as it is positive and as positive as it is negative, because I didn't have any sense of those structural and technical elements which can be used to make a story or a scene or a joke or a piece of comedy work. And it was after the festival, there was a guy who I mentioned earlier, actually, John Creamer, who's a member of the Maydays, which is my sort of main performance company. He was there, and the Maydays was recruiting, and he sent me an email saying, you seem like the right kind of chap, why don't you come and audition? And I auditioned and I got in. And that was my first kind of contact with long-form improvisation in the Harold-based sense.
Okay.
There's a sort of a turf war over whether long-form improvisation is used to mean narrative or used to mean Harold style in this country. So that's why I'm clarifying.
Right. Well, that does seem to me to be more of a tension. I don't know if tension's the right word, but a couple of paths that probably are more prominent in the UK than I think they are in the US when it comes to long form, in the sense that narrative or maybe genre-based improvisational in a longer piece or set seems like it's a bigger thing in the UK. I've heard you describe the impact of a group in Austin, Texas, Parallela Phonograph. Is that how you...
You're missing one syllable.
I figured I was. That. It didn't sound quite right.
Parallelogram of Phonograph.
There you go.
Simpler to call them P-Graph.
And they're a narrative-based long-form troupe. Correct?
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to me that there was some impact that they had on, at least at the time, on you and your feelings or philosophy on improv. Can you talk about that experience with them?
Sure. So it would have been, I'd like to be able to confidently state the year, but I was in Edinburgh performing with a narrative musical improv troupe called Music Box, who are still around. I don't believe that any of the same members, but the group is still around. As I was opening up my eyes to a wider variety of different improvs, it's very important to use that in the plural, I made a list of all of the improvisation shows that were happening at the Edinburgh Fringe, which was, I think, 120 or so. If you don't have an idea of the scale of the Edinburgh Fringe, a couple of years ago, I had a look just to, as part of a blog I was writing, and there were 4,000 different shows playing in the Edinburgh Fringe, and that is the ones which are registered in the official Fringe program.
Jeez.
There's then a bunch which are outside of the Fringe program. It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's completely huge.
Yeah.
And it's continued to grow. So I went through and I made a list of all the improvisation shows, and I started to go to as many of them as I possibly could, starting with the ones that I knew nothing about. And so I went to see this group, P-Graph, Parallelogram, Phonograph, who were doing, their show was called Improvised Plays from Austin, Texas, I think. Yes, that's correct. Mm-hmm. And they did a few different formats, because one of the things that P-Graph do, which I have, so there's many things they do which I love, but one of the things which I have so much respect for is they design a new show by noticing what they're not doing or doing badly, and then creating a show which necessitates them working on it. So they noticed, for example, that they weren't playing evil or nastiness or viciousness very well. So they created a show called Villainy in order that they would have to explore that.
Gotcha.
That's the whole point of the show. And so they were playing, they played four or five different formats, I think. And I went along to see them, thought they're extraordinary. And that was the point where the nursery had, for the first time, its own building, which was not a full-time theatre. We had to use temporary licences, so we couldn't put on shows the whole year round.
Okay.
But we were no longer doing the festival at the Olvik Tunnels, and so we decided, myself and a guy called Ryan Miller, who's now in Amsterdam, a Canadian guy who's now in Amsterdam, we decided to try the idea of putting on an international festival, which was before the kind of massive outbreak of international festivals across Europe. There's now one in sort of every major city. This was one of the first ones. And because we'd met P-Graph at the Edinburgh Fringe the year before, we said, hey, come along and do stuff at this first festival. And I think they became super influential for, I mean, no doubt P-Graph are absolutely fantastic. I think their influence in the London scene was partly because for a lot of people, it was the first American long-form improv team from a city which had been doing great improv for 10, 20, 30 years that anyone had seen.
Mm-hmm.
And the London improv, not the London improv scene, the London improv scene that I was part of, that set of people, that community, had just been starved of input from outside. We had done as much as we could ourselves. We'd got bits and pieces from, you know, Keith Johnson coming over and visiting. Some people had been to do the I.O. 5 weeker. There was bits and pieces coming in. But it was the first time, or one of the first times, or a very influential time. I'm trying to be very careful about not dismissing people. One of the first times in my community, in my experience, where an incredible team came in from the outside and said, this is how you do a thing. And we all looked at it and went, we didn't know that was possible.
Hmm.
I want to steal some of that stuff. And we had Shannon O'Neill from the UCB and some other performers come the next year. And we had people from Big Bang, which is Improv Boston, Will O'Hara, now down in Sarasota.
Mm-hmm.
We had all these influences over the kind of 2 or 3 years following, who probably would have been as impactful had they arrived first.
Mm-hmm.
It just happened to be that P-Graph were the first people in that wave of stuff arriving.
And were you seeking out these specific people for year 2, 3, you know, the different times through? Because you continue to draw folks from outside of the London community into to teach courses or for your festivals or other opportunities.
That's right, yeah. Dave Rosowski is at the nursery teaching right now. Yeah, I think when I joined, so a lot of the Maydays a few years before I joined the company had done the 5 weeker at I.O. and possibly had done a course at the Annoyance as well, possibly, and some of that kind of Chicago classic residential training. And I just couldn't afford it.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided that there must be a bunch of people like me who couldn't afford to take that training, and we would level up the entire community quicker by paying for one plane fare in this direction than 20 plane fares in the other direction.
Right.
So it was a concerted effort for me to get the training that I wanted, and also for me to bring all that knowledge into the London community in order that the community would get better as fast as possible. Because by this point, semi-consciously or probably fully consciously, I wanted to have the career of a professional improviser. I wanted to be doing that as a job. And I realized that the level of skill in this country was probably not high enough for me to be able to do it. So we needed to bring in a lot of outside influence. And I'm not taking credit for all of it in the slightest. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of other people who did huge amounts towards it, but that was the reason why I did that.
Sure, sure. And let me see if I can phrase this the right way. Are you curating who you bring with a certain style or sensibility to improv that you want to foster or think is better to pursue than perhaps some other styles or schools of thought might impact the community?
That is very delicately phrased. My taste reflects my background, as all of ours do, but my interest lies in something which is theatrically and emotionally led without necessarily being narrative. Narrative is, in the UK, it's the easiest thing to sell is to say, improvised this piece of IP. Or maybe, I don't know if that is actually the truth or whether that's just an endlessly repeated thing which people think, but it's certainly what people do very, very frequently. So I'm not necessarily interested in narrative stuff, although it's an easy framework to get bums on seats, but I'm definitely interested in something which mm-hmm. is connected, grounded, emotionally led, where I'm seeing people rather than comic ciphers on stage. Mm-hmm. While at the same time, one of the things I say in what I'm teaching all the time is I never want to be completely serious and I never want to be completely joking. I want to have that mm-hmm. little wry twinkle in the eye. And even as a character's going through hell, we're giving them the worst experience of their lives, I want to have a little twinkle in the eye. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, again, the sort of the Western conception of how do you create the style of something which is very silly and very serious at the same time asks it as an or, but I like to go for it mm-hmm. as an and. So I think that's the style which I go for. To be honest, I find it easier to navigate via the performers who I respect and bring over a lot. And, you know, P-Graph are absolutely wonderful. The Raz, Dave Rozowski, is a fantastic teacher. I've got a huge amount from the Big Bang, Freeform, Will O'Hara, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Dummy, Jason Schultz and Colleen Doyle are amazing. And there's something in the Venn diagram of all of those kind of teachers and performers. Armando Diaz, how could I forget Armando? I'm now just listing improv teachers who I respect. Kevin Scott.
There'll be plenty that I'm sure that you won't pull just in a moment, right?
Because, yeah, exactly. But there's something in the middle of all of those which feels to me to be united, or feels to me like they are, a lot of those teachers are teaching different paths to the same destination.
So maybe you already have, but let me ask this anyway. What do you think that destination is?
Oh, man. I guess I already have. I guess I find the question more interesting than the answer. Because questions are enlivening and curious and dynamic, and answers are kind of dead and smug. I guess my answer to that question is, how do you be completely serious and completely joking at the same time? And there's not a single answer to that question. It is it is something which is an ongoing question investigation.
Well, that was a how.
Yeah.
I guess I'm asking a why. Why would that be, or now I'm asking why, maybe I wasn't before. Why would that be the kind of destination you would seek or find worthwhile?
I guess because it's the show that I would want to watch, and all mm-hmm. the classes, all the shows that I do, all the classes that I teach, all the stuff that I write. What I have in mind is, what if there were someone like 15 years ago, Jules, in London, who doesn't know that this is what he's looking for, but it is. I would like to provide him or her or them with the material, experience and training to be able to get what I got out of improv quicker, because my process was super inefficient. Mm-hmm. And I understand that efficiency isn't the entire point.
Right.
I guess, yeah, you said earlier your first contact with improvisation, and I said that was my first experience of doing improvisation. The first improv show that I saw on stage, everyone saw Whose Line in the 80s. Obviously, it's brilliant. But the first show that I saw on stage was a show called Life Game, or I think Keith Johnston's Life Game, by a company called Improbable, who remain the reason why the nursery exists and my ongoing inspiration. And it was about 2001, 2002, I guess, maybe a little before that. I don't know if you know the Life Game format, but they get someone up from the audience and they mm-hmm. interview them about their life and they play out scenes from their life. And there's little short form kind of formats that go with it. And it was a show that was, I remember watching this and having the feeling that I get when I'm watching a really great piece of theatre or listening to a great piece of music for the first time, a feeling of coming home, a feeling of, oh, this is what I've been missing. And there was something about the honesty and cleanness of the emotion combined with the fact that it was just silly sometimes and that it would flip between the two of those things without either undermining the other. So I think probably part of my, that's the 10 years ago, Jules. 10 years ago, Jules was watching that show. So now I'm trying to provide that show for imaginary me in 2019. So yeah, that's a very influential show on my nascent improv psyche.
Yeah, the coming home phrase certainly can evoke a lot of emotions. I guess assuming you had a decent home life, different connotations, I suppose, otherwise. But that, I think, in some ways is part of the impetus for me to even pursue this podcast, was those kind of moments are impactful, not just in terms of drawing people to watch a show, but they have some sort of impact on the individual, both the performer and the audience member, I think. And that's a connection part to try to understand, because you're going back to your very first improv performance that you witnessed and still viewing it as a driver today. And you describe it as at least part of the driver for where you're trying to get to going forward.
Yeah.
Let me ask another question to maybe poke at this a little bit more. Do you think that improv has a specific purpose to it?
That's so funny. Have you heard of the Global Institute of Improvisation?
I feel like I have, but that could be just because the title is so grand.
It sounds authoritative, yeah. they did their first, I don't know if their first event, but it was their first full-scale conference earlier this year. And it was hosted at Middlesex University. I think it was Middlesex University. And they had the dean of something or other, or the professor and chair of something or other else. And he came on stage and he, in his introduction and the opening panel on, it was the second day rather than the first day, he posed the question to the room, is there an inherent morality to improvisation? And you're sort of asking the same question. Like, what's the point of the art form? And man, that question stuck in my head over the last kind of 3, 4, 5 months, however long it is. Not five. Because I'm absolutely convinced the answer is yes, but I don't know how to frame an answer which doesn't disintegrate into wooliness very quickly. There's something about liveness, cooperation, empathy, emotional as well as literal truth, the ability to create temporary communities and gain the benefits from that. There's something in all of that area which feels to me like it is for the bettering of humanity. And I think you and I are improv nerds, I suspect, would both say that, hey, if everyone in the world took an improv class every week, it would be a better place. But I find it hard to frame a convenient or pat answer to that specific question, because I don't think I've got there yet. And maybe it's one of those things like meditation, that there's no there to get to. It's the journey that's the point. So yeah, like, to me, it's something about revisiting those cognitive processes and reinforcing those cognitive processes which are threatened or weakened by the circumstances which we find ourselves in, and making sure that we hold on to those ways of thinking and feeling in the face of circumstances which make that difficult. Yeah. I think that's what it is, but I will disagree with myself when I listen to this podcast, and I will send you an email saying, no, I've got it.
Well, if you want to amend your remarks, yeah, just shoot me an MP3. I'll tag it on at the end.
And just put it in the middle. Yeah, it's a very interesting question, because I think the way that I'm interrogating that question at the moment is in part, like, what's the moral reason for something is very hard to think about. But why does it feel so good? Is something which I find interesting. So many people, when they take their first improv class, have the sense that their shoulders dropping and, oh, wow, I didn't realize I could have this power in the moment and this ability to do things. And if something, the sheer physical response to taking an improv class is one of those things that looks to me like it's accessing a very old part of the brain. It's like eating candy or, you know, having a hug. It's something where there's got to be a function for the reason why that feels so good, because the reason why things feel good is because they have an evolutionary advantage. And the question of whether it's eating candy, which is unhealthy, or having a hug, which is healthy, you know, whether it's a hack of the brain or whether it's a good usage of the brain is a very interesting one, I think.
Those things are maybe a little bit about coming home.
Yeah.
Because at home, there's candy and there's hugs. again, assuming a reasonably good childhood experience that you had.
Can the title of this episode of your podcast be Candy and Hugs?
Candy and Hugs, of course.
I don't know if you do titles for the thing, but.
I don't know. It sounds like somebody's got an improv group with that name out there. It's not the Impresarios, but it's darn close. So, Jules, I have a lot more that I'd like to chat with you about. I'm conscious of the time. Let me ask one last question, and then maybe we'll have another conversation on the rest of the things on that I wanted to get to. But
sure.
Let me ask you the question about what impact you feel you have, for good or for bad, on your and maybe this isn't the right way to look at it, but in the improv community that I would think would be most direct in the nursery theater, at least the improv aspect of that, on the type of improv doing, how much of your impact do you think is there, and how much are you trying to stay out of the way of something else happening?
Yeah, it's funny, as you were asking the question, do you know Asaf Ronan in I'm definitely pronouncing his name wrong. Yeah. I apologize. In Austin, Texas, he wrote what is the only book about directing improv that I know about, and maybe others.
Okay.
And it's called Show the Way by Getting Out of the Way, which I really love as an idea. The nursery team is 11 people. There's three of us who do the artistic direction. There's two of us who direct the company. There's all of the people on the team play in different shows, direct different shows. And I think my role in the nursery is to make the shows that I want to make and to do the improv that I want to do, absolutely, but also to provide the space for other people to be able to make things, to make high quality work. I don't want the nursery to be a place which is a top-down ideology of how improv should be. I think one of the reasons why we brought over so many different teachers from so many different places in America and across Europe as well,
yep,
is just looking for that thrill of, when I go to improvisation festivals, I don't go to as many now as I did a couple of years ago, but when I go, what I'm looking for is watching a show and having the sensation of, huh, I didn't know that was possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the feeling which I'm interested in engendering in our community, is the space for people to experiment and tinker and create things where they realize, they think, huh, I didn't know that was possible. And I think, hey, I didn't know that was possible.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is a wonderful story of, oh, I've forgotten his name. Famous biologist.
Oh, well, now I'll be of great help to you.
Oh, what's his name? Anyway,
send it to me. I will place it in. You go ahead and go do a run up, leave a pause. I'll plunk in the name.
Okay, there was a famous biologist called, there we are, and he was at the back of a lecture hall listening to a lecture by this upstart young researcher who had proven the work of this older researcher to be incorrect and to have been incorrect for 30 years, that he'd been completely going down the wrong path. And at the end of this lecture, the older guy, the guy whose work had been proved incorrect, marched down to the front of the lecture hall, grabbed the guy by the hand, shook his hand, smiled, gave him a massive hug, and said, "Thank you for making us as a community more right."
Mm.
And I find that such a sort of beautiful ideal that I hope that I get to see more and more shows which I have directly or indirectly had a hand in creating or making it possible to create, where I look at it and go, I would have said that shouldn't work, but hey, it does. Nice work. Mm-hmm. That's the place that I want. And I've got lots of shows that I want to make, and I've got lots of shows that I want to keep doing. And you know, I love improvising, and next couple of weeks I'm going to Birmingham to do that festival, and I'm playing with Raz, and I'm going to Bulgaria. I'm doing all those things. I want to keep working as a performer, but I think it's really important that I separate my work as a performer from my work as a manager or artistic director, because as a performer, I do the things that I'm good at, but as an artistic director and manager, my job is to make sure that everyone else does the things that they're good at. I'm guessing as an American, you don't know much about rugby, but there's a coach called Eddie Jones, who's the current England coach. He's a New Zealander by birth, but he's famous for going into sides which are having difficulty and turning them around and turn them into incredible kind of world-beating sides. He coached Japan when they defeated South Africa at the last World Cup, which is something which should not happen. Mm-hmm. You know, that doesn't make any sense in terms of statistics and form. And the way that the thing that he does when he arrives at a team is not to say, this is how you play rugby and this is what you should be doing. He says, hey, what are you good at? Let's make you better at it. So the two teams that he's coached recently is Japan, who are fast, organized, incredibly fit, like insanely fit. They will run back and forward across the width of the field over and over and over again until the defense of any other team just can't keep up, and they get in and score. And that was one of the things which he put in. And then England, who he's currently coaching, are just powerful and arrogant as a team. And one of the descriptions which I loved of England under Eddie Jones is they play as if there isn't another team on the field. And it's beautiful to watch. And so I think that that's a really, really wonderful way of approaching it. And that's how I try to teach, coach, and manage. So what are you good at? Let's do more. That was a long answer, but mine tend to be.
Well, I appreciate all of the answers. You described them as dead and something earlier. I don't think any of them were. I really thank you for sharing some time on this. Like I said, there's a lot more that I had on my list to chat with you about, but I really appreciate you being on the Improv Comedy Connection.
Well, thank you so much for your time. It's been a lovely conversation. Thank you.
There are going to be a lot of reasons to get into improv, comedy, theater, etc. But what drew you in was probably something beautiful and personally impactful. That concept of coming home might be part of your story or something along those lines. I appreciated that phraseology in that discussion because I think returning to those aspects of the early on moments that got you hooked can be really important to return to when maybe things are a bit tough or perhaps aren't clicking the way you'd like them to. Maybe some candy and hugs can recenter you and get you to go farther. We covered a lot of ground in our conversation, and I'm sure you appreciated Jules' thoughtfulness about all things improv. You can check out his site at julesmunz.com, and I'll be sure to post links to that and much more on the episode page at improvcomedyconnection.com. As of the finalization of this episode, I know there are some ongoing challenges for the Nursery Theater to secure new teaching and performance space. So for that and other reasons, keep Jules and the rest of the team at the Nursery in your thoughts, as these are big challenges for maintaining and running an improv theater. Dropping a note or showing some tangible expression of support would, I'm sure, be most welcome at this time. As I do in each episode, I invite your help in spreading the word about this podcast. If this is a valuable resource, would you take the time to share this podcast with someone you know in improv, comedy, communication, or theater? It's been really great to see the organic growth of the podcast and that we have listeners across the globe. But you sharing the podcast with one or two people would really be a great honor, and it will be noticed and motivating for me to keep going with all these great guests. I'm doing this to be of help to you as we work together to connect more deeply with each other and our audiences through comedy. So your participation in that and feedback is very much appreciated. I've loved being your host on this episode of the Improv Comedy Connection. My name again is Whit Schiller, and I'm an improviser out of Milwaukee with Fishsticks Comedy. You can check us out at fishstickscomedy.com, and you can connect with me on social media at Whit Schiller on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. It's getting close to the end of 2019, so my year in review photo book from Snapfish will soon be available for purchase. Just let me know if you want me to have one printed for you too. Thanks for tuning in to the Improv Comedy Connection.